Preface. This book was begun several years ago. It arose out of a public crisis and a private need. A need to take stock while there was still time. A need to find out just how much and how little I really knew about myself and the universe in which I had somehow occurred. It seemed a pity to die before I had had time to be surprised at being alive, or actively curious as to what man amounted to, if indeed he amounted to anything. Though the present book has grown far beyond my first attempts to meet such a situation, still it remains an effort to answer the question, what am I? Whatever the human mystery may be, I am it. What is man? This is the riddle which everyone, while accepting all the outside help he can get and use, must solve after his own fashion. My solution, if it can be called that, will not, in its entirety, do for anybody else, and it is offered here more as an incentive than as a guide. In any case, I have no complete, self-consistent, well-rounded system, but only the sketch plan of a philosophy. The nature of man is a baffling and inexhaustible topic about which I do not wish to dogmatize. While I can say, with Thoreau, I should not talk so much about myself if there were anybody else whom I knew as well, I have to admit that I am increasingly a stranger to myself. Of the two kinds of men, those who refuse to take the advice, know thyself, and those who imagine they have done so, the second is perhaps the less wise. Knowledge that is not counterbalanced with knowledge of ignorance is mere dead weight. This is a philosophical book. But to prevent misunderstanding, I must explain at once that the term philosophy, as I use it, bears a meaning which is not always accepted nowadays. Firstly, I avoid as far as possible the metaphysics, which, remote from the concrete details of nature, loses itself in a fog of words. Philosophy has been defined as the sum of scientific knowledge, or an attempt to unify the sciences. My intention is not so ambitious, but I do wish to suggest lines along which the chief results of the separate sciences may one day coalesce into a science. Secondly, this book is a practical enterprise. Many philosophers, and amongst them the greatest, have held that philosophy is much more than thinking about the important things. It demands and includes appropriate ways of behaving. I shall have a good deal to say on this subject. Thirdly, this book is speculative. I hope boldly so. Though in the main I agree with Samuel Alexander that true or concrete thought is tied down to nature, I dare not claim that all my balloons are captive ones. Some of them sail off into the blue. But is not the view from above, the widest possible perspective, just what we require if we are to find ourselves in the universe? At present, we do not know where we are, though it is clear that we are not at home. Philosophy has failed us. There is a trenchant passage in Kierkegaard's journals where he says that, in relation to their systems, most systematizers are like a man who builds an enormous castle and lives in a shack close by. Our real need is neither castle nor shack, but a home in the universe, something between a hovel and an equally uninhabitable front parlour, something that is neither the skeptic's cosmic slum nor the tidy but insubstantial and draughty constructions of the armchair metaphysician. I believe we are desperate for lack of a world picture in which our own lives fill a perceptible corner. A picture with enough richness of colour and generous detail to fire the imagination, with that conformity to science which any robust intellect demands, and with that clear portrayal of cosmic unity and purpose which alone will satisfy the heart. This book is the rough cartoon of such a picture. Next, as to the presentation. I know of no reason why serious books on philosophical subjects should not be as easy to listen to as the theme allows. Accordingly, I have tried to write in terms that the educated non-specialist will follow. Actually, no doubt the book's intelligibility will depend more upon the listener's sympathies and antipathies than upon any other factor. Whether he is or is not a visualizer will also make a difference. The reason for the dialogues between my unreflecting or common sense self, C, and my philosophical self, P, which are scattered throughout these pages, is that thinking naturally falls into such a shape. Thought, as Plato observed, is a dialogue of the soul with herself, and in the course of this inward talk, C, though often worsted by P, is never worsted for good, but recovers again and again to play an indispensable part. Let me say here, once and for all, that no man, and least of all a philosopher, can afford to disown this hopelessly unphilosophical side of himself. A hint about listening to the book. I must warn listeners against dipping in here and there. Sampling can only mislead because the plan of the work is roughly dialectical. The findings of earlier chapters are modified later on, and later chapters need the backing of earlier ones if they are to be understood. The whole must be listened to. There will be many things to bring my listeners to a standstill, but like Spinoza, I pray them to proceed gently with me and form no judgment concerning things until they have heard all. Even so, there is a highly cultivated type of mind to whom much of what I have to say will remain meaningless. I know the value of the mentality that has no use for speculation, for it is to the intellectual ascetic, with his patient attention to detail and his refusal to go more than an inch at a time beyond the evidence, that I owe many of the data on which are based the constructions which he condemns as, at best, premature. All I can suggest to him is that our attitudes are complementary, and that there is as deep and as practical a need for large-scale structures of thought as for their building materials. Let him allow me my function as I allow his. It is little use pointing out that I have failed in it. I know that already. Constructive proposals are wanted. As the Chinese sage remarks, the man who criticizes others must have something as an alternative. To criticize without an alternative is like using fire to put out a fire. There is another type of listener to whom much of what I have to say will be all too acceptable. I refer to the lazy-minded and intellectually undisciplined enthusiast, to the cult-monger who, unprepared for the long grind of working his way through stubborn facts towards the goal of his desire, tries to leap there at a single bound. But, in fact, quick advance leads nowhere, and nothing worthwhile is achieved without industry, patience, and humility. Let there be speculation about man and the universe, without it man is not himself, but let it be informed speculation, not idle. The warning of Heraclitus that men that love wisdom must be acquainted with very many things indeed is more to the point now than ever it was. Dr. F. Sherwood Taylor underestimates neither the size nor the urgency of the task when he writes, "The only hope for the world is the incorporation of the religious, philosophical, and scientific outlooks in a single comprehensive view, and I would say emphatically that this incorporation has not been accomplished, and that its accomplishment is the most immediate and urgent of tasks for those who wish men well." We are due for a synthesis. The scientific jungle needs the taming hand of the thinker and the saint. On the other hand, philosophy confined in the luxuriant growth of modern science just the food she should have for further growth, while religion can find in it a much-needed purgative and tonic. Dr. Inger has told us that the task of the century is to spiritualize science. It is also, I would add, to intellectualize religion. In both tasks, philosophy has a great opportunity and a great responsibility. The following pages are an attempt to discharge my own share of this responsibility. Finally, let me emphasize the fact that I carry no stock of patent medicines or labor-saving devices. I can offer no easy way out or in, no shortcut to bliss, no philosophy without tears, no brand new gospel. All I can promise are some ancient teachings in modern dress, teachings that are difficult only because they are simple and must be lived to be understood, together with some old recipes for hope and confidence. The merely newfangled is as useless as the merely traditional. We must go forward to new ideas and back to old ones. We must get down to the facts of science and wake up to those of religion. Genuine progress is not one-way advance from the present into the future, but the symmetrical expansion of the present pastwards and futurewards, so that time is in some sense transcended. D.H. Lawrence is surely right when he says, "Every profound new movement makes a great swing also backwards to some older, half-forgotten way of consciousness." A note on the relation of this inquiry to metaphysics, science, and logical positivism. What is the task of the modern philosopher? Logical positivists, dismissing one of his traditional functions as the excogitation of metaphysical nonsense, and another as unwarranted encroachment upon the realm of science, leave him with only a tiny fraction of his work. Professor Ayer writes, "The propositions of philosophy are not factual, but linguistic in character. That is, they do not describe the behavior of physical or even mental objects. They express definitions, or the formal consequences of definitions. Accordingly, we may say that philosophy is a department of logic." And the view that philosophy is a kind of speculative knowledge existing alongside the special sciences is quite mistaken. Those who make this supposition cherish the belief that there are some things in the world which are possible objects of speculative knowledge and yet lie beyond the scope of empirical science. But this belief is a delusion. There is no field of experience which cannot, in principle, be brought under some form of scientific law, and no type of speculative knowledge about the world which it is, in principle, beyond the power of science to give. Now, I do not dispute the usefulness of much of the logical positivists' criticism of metaphysical thought structures, or of their efforts at demolition and the removal of rubbish. Nor indeed can Mr. Ayer be denied the right to define philosophy as a department of logic. Nevertheless, this definition seems to me to depart from usage unnecessarily. Moreover, it leaves anonymous that small but not superfluous class of persons who are neither scientists, nor metaphysicians, nor logicians, but who desire to take as their subject matter the chief findings of these special sciences, and, cutting across all departmental barriers, to find the larger pattern. Logical positivists would reply, I suppose, that insofar as this task of integration is neither a matter of metaphysics, i.e. of a peculiar kind of nonsense, nor a matter of logical analysis, i.e. of philosophy proper, it is the task of science, in which the philosopher has no business to meddle. Ideally, perhaps this is so. T.H. Huxley defines science as all knowledge that rests upon evidence and reasoning. And Dr. Alex Hill goes so far as to say that all intelligent knowledge is science. But I think it is clear, first, that science shows few signs of undertaking this work of self-integration. Second, that the individual scientist, by reason of his inevitable and necessary specialization, is scarcely the man for the job. Third, that the method of the work cannot yet, if ever, be exact or scientific, but must be rambling, speculative, and provisional. Fourth, that the project is worthwhile all the same, and even important. Therefore, I say that until such time as science can take over, supposing that time should come, there exists a need for a more or less non-metaphysical philosophy, whose propositions are factual rather than linguistic. Lacking such a philosophy, we are overwhelmed with huge masses of uncoordinated information about ourselves and the universe. To many people, this state of affairs is intellectually and aesthetically intolerable. It may be said in reply, of course, that actually there is no work for the kind of philosophy I propose, or that the work, though desirable, is too difficult to succeed. To these objections, the present book is my answer. While I cannot expect any listener to agree with all that I say, in detail, I do claim to show, 1, that important new propositions about the universe, propositions which are neither nonsense on the one hand, nor tautological on the other, which are not confined to any particular science, but nevertheless have an empirical basis, are forthcoming. 2, that some of these propositions are capable of suggesting new and fruitful lines of research in the special sciences. 3, that such cross-fertilization of the existing sciences is capable of leading to the birth of a new science or sciences. Let me give one example. In the following pages, I show that there exist, besides the physical and chemical and biological units which are our scientific stock in trade, several kinds of objects which are concrete, material things, offering an abundance of empirical evidence as to their nature. The scientist ignores them, for their temporal dimensions place them beyond the borders of his field of view. The specious present he takes to them is too brief to contain them. In other words, they are non-existent for him because he does not give them time to exist. He destroys their essential character by dividing their time. Here, then, is work for the philosopher, to discern and to study the numerous orders of physical, or rather psychophysical, units whose only disqualification is that their minimum time, the time they need to be themselves, is somewhat greater than science is as yet prepared to recognize. In this case at least, the present limitations of science and common sense demand that philosophy shall do precisely what Professor Ayer declares it cannot do, namely, afford knowledge of a reality transcending the world of science and common sense. It is to be hoped indeed that science will eventually take over the study that philosophy thus initiates. Meantime, the philosopher must do the best he can. And after all, this function of bringing to birth and rearing the infant sciences is none other than that which positivists generally accord to philosophy. The only mistake of Comte and his followers in this respect is to suppose that philosophy is now old and past bearing, and that the family of grown-up sciences can have little further use for their mother. I try to show that, on the contrary, she is still the head of the family, without whom the children are either strangers or at loggerheads, and still capable of adding to their number. I suggest that there is not one remedy for the well-advertised infertility of philosophy, but two, and that though they seem utterly opposed, they are really complementary. The first is the positivists, who demands that the philosopher should narrow his field to certain very limited but answerable problems lying on the borderland of science. The second is the one advocated in this book, namely that the philosopher should broaden his field till it includes the whole territory of science and art and religion. Both remedies reduce the pretensions of philosophy, the first by the method of abstraction and exclusion, and the second by the method of concreteness and inclusion. The first is the philosopher's self-denying ordinance, the second his act of generous acceptance and outgoing, and each needs the other. It is the present business of philosophy to find out what she can hope to do in her own very restricted department, and what she can hope to do as the general liaison officer between all the great departments of human endeavour. The second of these tasks is beset by a pair of formidable difficulties, of language and of human capacity. 1. My aim is always to cut across, to imitate the processes of a universe which is no respecter of departmental boundaries, to bring together regions of human experience that have become increasingly isolated. But each region, just because of its isolation and its own internal needs, has developed a language and thought habits of its own. Its intellectual fauna, so to say, are Australasian. The consequence is that in our age, a symposium consisting of, say, a physicist, an artist, a philosopher, a psychologist and a theologian, to include no others, could only begin to make sense if all agreed to speak in the lay lingua franca of everyday life, and thus to abandon innumerable professional subtleties. Indeed, we are so departmentalized that even two of the same profession, two psychologists or two philosophers, if they should happen to belong to different schools, are likely to find each other almost unintelligible. 2. And it is not only this appalling confusion of tongues which makes the labour of integration so difficult, as well as so desirable. A further impediment is the vast discrepancy between the work and the workman. Obviously, the volume of modern knowledge is so great that its unification has to be a long-term cooperative enterprise to which no individual can make more than a modest contribution. Is the attempt, then, hopeless? We cannot know the answer in advance, a priori, without ourselves trying to find it. To say the very least, the experiment in cosmology must go on. But its limiting conditions, particularly the linguistic, must never be forgotten. The interdepartmental lingua franca, which I have adopted for this inquiry, has all the defects of imprecision that are inevitable in such a medium. But plainly, the unifying purpose of this book demands a certain verbal neutrality. It cannot be written in the language of any one particular department or level, and certainly not in the highly specialized language used by logical positivists. For the topic determines the medium of its discussion, and only very abstract or very circumscribed themes can be treated with logical strictness. Not surprisingly, the concrete and many-leveled universe, sublimely mad as it often seems, declines to be coaxed into any of our standard linguistic straitjackets. But that is scarcely sufficient reason for pretending that it does not exist, or that if it exists, it is not a seemly topic for discussion, or that its study, cosmology, that word of current philosophic abuse, is a solecism, analogous to astrology, perhaps, or to the shadier or grubbier varieties of occultism. What this book is about, the hierarchy, is no figment, and it lends itself to empirical study on its own terms. Refusal to accept these terms is not a comment upon the thing or its study, but upon human ineptitude. And it is no more scientific than a denial that man exists qua man, on the grounds that he is not retained on the mesh through which physical science passes him. Accordingly, my aim is to bring together, whenever possible, the most diverse testimonies of poets and mystics and even of primitive man, no less than of philosophers and scientists. But it is essential to remember that these juxtapositions do not imply that a work of imagination and a work of piety and a work of science enjoy the same status, or that the methods and results of any one of these three has any unmediated relevance to the others. Each is, in one sense, self-contained. And it is precisely on this account, precisely because the honest scientist does not allow his aesthetic and religious preferences to sway his professional judgment, because the true artist is not primarily out to instruct or improve us, because the genuine mystic and the saint are not as such concerned to further our science and art, that the delivery of each is, in the end, so relevant to the others. As in the departments of science, so here, temporary separation makes the eventual reunion 10 times more fruitful. To the degree that science and art and religion suffer no mutual dilution, to that degree is their evidence, when at last it converges, and this, as I shall show, is very often trebly powerful. There has been a minimum of collusion. In any case, whether explicitly or unexplicitly, the synthesis has to be made. Insofar as a man is a mere scientist, or artist, or saint, he is a monster. Insofar as the scientist and artist and saint hold aloof from one another in him, he is not one person but three, an unholy and unhealthy trinity. Insofar as they are hopelessly mixed up, he creates nothing. Insofar as they are distinct but united, poles which can neither merge nor part, he approaches creative completeness. I take the question not to be whether the synthesis which I seek in this book is possible, but rather how far our daily and hourly versions of it shall remain imperfectly conscious and haphazard. At least it is worthwhile considering whether the mutual separation of the intellectual and aesthetic and religious sides of our life has not now reached a stage where each is thereby seriously distorted, and whether, in particular, our thinking does not become increasingly unrealistic and trivial as it engages less and less of the total personality of the thinker. I beg leave to doubt whether he thinks well who only thinks, whether the philosopher can transcend the man, whether it would not be useful to ask once more that our teachers should be all-round or balanced men, whether there are not, perhaps, important aspects of the universe which are misapprehended to the degree that they are apprehended by the mere specialist. In any case, if we wish to call a halt in our intellectual journey on the grounds that the path of reason by which we have come does not lead onwards by itself, but is joined by others of a different class, we would do well to tolerate the few who want to go on, just in case there is anything worth finding. It is not impossible that, after all, there should be something in the 13th century Augustinian's conviction that there is no field that belongs to reason alone, and that the unity which reason seeks transcends reason. Besides, there is the practical question. D.H. Lawrence wrote, "If we do not rapidly open all the doors of consciousness and freshen the putrid little space in which we are cribbed, the sky-blue walls of our unventilated heaven will be bright red with blood." Whether this is true or not, it would be unwise to defer the consideration of such matters till every logical nicety has been cleared up. That is to say, till doomsday. If philosophers refuse to contemplate the universe, it is liable to force itself upon their attention in ways that are unpleasant. If the captain of the fire brigade goes on demanding an accurate survey of the nature and extent of the conflagration before he will budge, then he is liable before long to find the fire station itself in flames.